This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is March 22nd, 2024.
I'm Stark Lindebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, here in BC, the NDP are riding high on the polls, and federally, the NDP are ticking off parts of their agreement with the Liberals, and there's some other stuff happening, but it's quiet. It's spring break for at least the provincial legislature. But we'll get into my least favorite topic of just like dissecting polls. Patreon.com/politicoast to help make this worthwhile to keep going through the quiet times. As mentioned, two big polls in BC this week. First, Angus Reid Institute, and second, Main Street. Angus Reid, the top line numbers were not that surprising compared to everything we've seen so far. The NDP with a healthy lead of 21 points over the divided opposition, 43% to 22% for the Conservatives and BC United each, and 12% for the Green. What's interesting in here is, well, EB has a pretty strong approval rating. He has the support of 47% of British Columbians who approve somewhat or quite a bit strongly of his performance so far, and that puts him in the top echelons of Canadian premiers, up with such starlings as Danielle Smith, but not as good as Scott Moe, I think. Those Saskatchewan premiers can do no wrong, no matter how many times they drink and drive.
I thought Moe had taken quite a dive in the polls in the last year or so.
I don't have all of the ones in front of me. I'll pull that up while you get into the interesting part of this poll, which is how, despite his popularity, people don't think he's actually doing a good job on anything.
Yeah, so this is the thing that really stood out to me when I flipped through this poll. It wasn't the top lines, which, like you said, are kind of in line with what we've been seeing and are not as shocking as the next poll we'll talk about. The thing that really stood out to me was the issue set they pulled on and how the government seemed to be doing on it. So running down the list of the major issues where people in the poll could select up to three of these: cost of living, 60%, healthcare, 50%, housing affordability, 40%, crime, public safety at 26%, environment at 21%, kind of goes down from there through poverty and homelessness, drug use, addiction, opioid crisis, economy, jobs, etc. Won't read them all out because reading every line of a poll gets a little boring on a podcast. But what's interesting is when asked how the government is doing on these most important issues, they were not given particularly high marks. So for top line one, cost of living, the government has 78% of people saying they're doing a poor job to 17. Healthcare was 68% disapproved to 27. Housing affordability, 78 to 17. So if you actually look at what British Columbians are saying as their top issues, the government is not doing a good job in their eyes, which really contrasts with just the top line numbers as well as the response when asked which party leader is best suited to handle each for the next 4 years. EB does well on healthcare, cost of living, housing affordability, tied with the Greens on environment, climate change. Not a surprise on that. And frankly, beats the other two on public safety as well, which is unusual for a left of center party.
I'll come back to that in a second, but I found the March 2024 Angus Reid premier approval ratings. It's Wab Kanu, who's the most popular premier in Canada,
Made sense. Still around the post-election.
Yeah, exactly. Race. The honeymoon period, he's at 63%, but Scott Moe's at 53%. So he is massively outperforming his party, the Saskatchewan Party, who in the last couple polls I've seen is potentially trailing the Saskatchewan NDP. And so people like him, but they hate his government and might not vote for them. Anthony Fury out in Newfoundland and Tim Houston in Nova Scotia are also sitting in the 40%. It's Doug Ford, Francois Legault, and Blaine Higgs, who are down in the 30s. But those
wacky Quebec politics just really swing, don't they?
We have no thoughts on Quebec politics because we have no connection. Yeah. Just it's really funny to see, the Parti Québécois surging again out of nowhere. Here in BC, I think what we see in this Angus Reid poll, as much as I want to spend on it, which is not much, is that standard situation where people are unhappy with all of these issues and are a little frustrated by where they're at. But in terms of the choices on offer, they see a government that's trying. They might be disappointed, but they're willing to give it a bit more time to try, and opposition parties who they don't trust to solve those issues any better. And that's somewhat a testament of the lack of solutions being offered by either's, or where we've talked about their policies. When we look back at the BC United housing policy, the like best ideas, which weren't many, were taken by the BC NDP in the budget of like, hey, maybe we could expand this tax credit a little bit to be a little bit more fair. Sure, whatever. Here you go. And BC Conservatives, I don't think people actually know who they are. They just know they're conservative and they don't like Kevin Falcon, and BC United is either confusing or they're still sour on BC Liberals. And so there is a huge opportunity for the opposition to gain traction if they can bring forward a coherent plan. But the Conservatives spend a lot of time on outrage, and BC United picked the funniest name for how it has worked out for them.
Well, I mean, I know I've said it a few times before, but like that was a classic case of trying to manage the coalition rather than actually put forward a value proposition. And unsurprisingly, like that name backfired terribly. I'm not even sure it's the case where they need to, you know, put together a 40-point plan and be, you know, the most dialed in a way that, you know, all the policy wants absolutely love in this. They're opposition parties. They can, to a certain extent, gain a lot of traction from channeling the discontents on these issues, and that they haven't actually been able to do that is quite interesting on this, and both tells you where the two main opposition parties' weaknesses are, but also where there's a lot of room to potentially exploit in the upcoming campaign if they can actually get their act together and come up with a coherent message on that and just connect better, which Falcon in particular seems terrible at. He has all the charisma and connection of a bland corporate presentation.
Which I guess brings us to the other poll that's more interesting, but possibly less reliable, depending how your feelings are about Main Street as a firm. Main Street being notably, before we get to the numbers, the firm that predicted Bill Smith would win the 2017 Calgary by-election and the BC Liberals would win a 2019 Nanaimo by-election.
Right level polling's hard to do. Like I'm not gonna dunk on them too much for missing a single riding's polling on that, or you know, a ward in one city on that. Still, you know, they're not the top echelon of Canadian pollsters. What is interesting in this one isn't so much the numbers themselves, although those are really interesting. It's about what I think is going to happen from those numbers coming out. But first, why don't you just give people kind of the top lines on these, on where
Well, it depends whether I It depends whether I read the subhead of their press release or the first paragraph, but they round to the same number, so they must be fine. BC NDP 39.6%, BC Conservatives 34.2%, and BC United is either at 14.5 or 14.2%. Trivially different, but it annoys me. And the BC Greens are at 9.6%. So it actually looks like a race between the NDP and Conservatives, with the United being largely pushed out. Like, the NDP is still in a healthy position ahead, but they note in the press release, we don't have the full poll to look at all the crosstabs, but Conservatives are holding a 9-point lead among male voters, and the NDP has a 20-point lead among female voters. And there's usually a gender difference, but that seems pronounced. Regionally, they say that...
I'm not sure if that's... Like, there's a very pronounced gender difference on the federal polling, so I could potentially see a bit of that trickling down to the provincial level stuff as well. That big a gap, though, for a party that's really surged like the Conservatives has me slightly skeptical on that. But
they say the BC Conservatives are in the lead in the interior by 10 points, are tied with the NDP on Vancouver Island, and trail the NDP by 11 points in Greater Vancouver, which, based on that, those regional numbers, makes it for a wild election.
Yeah, so I saw some of the modeling people did just off this poll that had the BC United with as few as zero seats and as many as four based on that. Maybe six, I think, on some of them. So yeah, wild election. This a little more on the outlier. So by comparison, the 338 has the NDP at 46, Conservatives at 22, and United at 3. Now, the two opposition parties are outside of the margin of error of each other, but not by much on that. So yeah, I think there's like a not unreasonable chance there's a bit of an outlier on this. Nevertheless, like, what I think's actually really interesting here is the play this got, which, not unsurprising, because it's a polling result we haven't seen before, and particularly it really seems to confirm the sense that BC United's flailing and the Conservatives are on an upswing. Clearly rattled BC United, because that afternoon they dropped Oppo on like six BC Conservative candidates, although Oppo might be a little generous on a few of them, but clearly they felt rattled enough to go on the attack against the Conservatives on this one, rather than just dismissing it as an outlying poll. And so far, the United has had an advantage in terms of organizational heft, fundraising. Conservatives have not closed the gap on this. What I think is going to be very interesting is, if particularly if we get another poll that also shows a split beyond a few points on there, is that you'll likely start to see a lot of the undecided switcher, people on the right half of the spectrum who aren't sure how they're going to vote may start to coalesce a little more around that. Donations often follow political success, and in that sense, you will likely see a boosting the Conservatives' fundraising ability to recruit candidates, get organizers, and all of that, which might actually make this one of the more consequential polls we'll have this year, just on that front alone, is that it sets the narrative, and it as a result may generate some on the ground realities to be different than they would have been otherwise.
Yeah, this, looking historically, is the best poll for the Conservative Party of British Columbia since, let's go back to 19... I can't even find a good one, because they were kind of in coalition in the war period. You have to go back.
So polling wasn't great back then?
Yeah, so They got,
like, in modern polling,
they got 53% in the 1928 election. And then they got 30% in a couple elections after that. They're at, what did I say, 32% in this poll. In that period where Christy Clark was looking really damaged in 2012, 2013, the conservatives were never in second place. There was not one poll that I see, at least on the Wikipedia chart, that has them. They got neck and neck within a point or two, but the liberals stayed in second place. And that at least gave them some authority to, especially as government, fight their way back. And looking back, you can see the trend line from like October 2012 until the election starts to move up. And that campaign notably did not have the NDP ever behind the liberals, so much so that in March 2013, the province ran the famous front page headline, "If this man kicked a dog, he'd still win the election," talking about how all the pollsters said it is literally impossible for Dave. Well, not literally impossible, but almost. Literally, almost.
They all caveat. A lot of them.
They basically all put a little caveat as, like, I guess it could happen that Christy Clark would win, but it seems like Dix has this in the bag.
What didn't one of them go so far as to say she'd have to fight off aliens or something to get the boost she'd need to win?
Vancouver Island University commentator Alan Warnke told them that he was suspecting the liberals might come back with fewer than 5 or 10 seats, and if so, they will disappear. Christie would have to carry out some deeds that would instantly bury all past foul-ups. All I can conjure up now is an image of her battling aliens like David Crockett at the Alamo. Who knows? Maybe she will get lucky. And, like, David Eby is in a different position than Adrian Dix, obviously, because government and incumbency is a strong drug in this country. It's very helpful for especially mayors and premiers, because Canadians have this aversion to change in politics.
Yeah, like, it's notable that even when the BC Liberals were tired, that last election in 2017, they still put in a campaign that netted them the plurality of the seats. That is only the post-election confidence maneuverings that actually ended up costing them. And then as soon as they were out of government, things just flipped on.
Yeah, they won the most votes. They won the most seats narrowly.
And they never really recovered from losing the incumbency advantages. In fact, one of the big problems was after 16 years, they had kind of acclimatized themselves to it and were not able to pivot to opposition all that well.
Well, and Christy Clark's months before the election campaign were filled with scandals, right? It was a really rough time for her. And it was only during the campaign that she really started to paint a vision in 2013 of what she would do as premier. And that vision was jobs, jobs, jobs. By contrast, the BC NDP are not facing that many scandals. And Eby is personally relatively popular and is trying. You can see he's at least trying. He may not agree with the policies he's doing, but he's acknowledging the issues that need to be acknowledged.
Yeah, they've run a remarkably scandal-free government that's been around for quite a while at this point. And B, they're really good at losing quickly, which is an underrated skill in politics. You have not seen this government, either Eby or Horgan, stick to a losing proposition long enough for it to really cost them. You know, when the museum renovation went sideways on them, that was canceled within a couple weeks. The Land Act changes, they walked that back. It's like, okay, we'll reassess this and go back. We might go back later and do this right. Things like that. They're just pretty quick at recognizing when they're in a bad position and changing it. And that's Some of this actually made the opposition's job really hard. And, you know, barring some scandal that is as unexpected as Christy Clark fighting off aliens, it's going to be hard to see what changes that general approach in the next several months. But you never know. It's BC politics. It can get weird.
He could. He may kick a dog, in fact. He has kicked off a bit of a war of words with federal conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. Poilievre has been sounding off for weeks about the plan to increase the federal carbon tax on April 1st, complaining that, you know, this is going to hit workers and people so hard, and we need to not do this for the good of people's pocketbooks. BC not being a part of the federal carbon tax system, although if we didn't increase it, we would face the backstop, presumably. We're just going on with it, especially since there was a cross-partisan consensus around it, given that it was introduced by the BC Liberals. BC Greens supported it, and the BC NDP have supported it since 2010, when Harold James stopped being premier after the Axe the Tax campaign went so bad.
Well, she never started.
Exactly. Premier, but, stopped being leader.
I will also take issue with one thing you said there. I don't think David Eadry kicked this off. It was fair, very clear that you probably have kicked it off on that. That said, both of them, I think, would benefit from having this war of words on it. So neither of them are intent or have any real incentive not to just carry on with it, because it plays well to both of their bases.
Indeed. EB said in reply to a question about what Poilievre had been sending, which was a specific letter to him asking him to join the conservative premiers across the country in opposing the carbon tax hike, quote, "I don't live in Pierre Poilievre's campaign office and baloney factory. I live in British Columbia. I'm the premier. Decisions have consequences." Just trying to be the grown-up in the room. He went on to say if he really wants to help British Columbians with affordability, he could place a phone call to John Rustad and Kevin Balkan and encourage them to support our housing initiatives, which is actually a very sharp point given EB and Poilievre might agree more on housing, at least broadly.
In the broad strokes,
than some of the opposition has been mulling around, although I'm not totally clear on where either the opposition parties stand on the broad scope of increasing density in our cities. But yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, the BC United hasn't had a clear line on, pretty much anything, and housing's no different. I suspect the Conservatives have a general pro-building more homes, but there isn't, they haven't been specifics yet, and I suspect we won't get any till the campaign really kicks into gear there.
There's also just less specifics that the federal government can set out. Like, the federal government can't change zoning laws. But that's why they've said, you know, we're going to set bigger and bigger targets for housing construction, and cities just do whatever they need to get it done. And even the Liberals' Housing Accelerator Fund is just like, here's some money if you...
We'll bribe you.
Yeah, we'll bribe you. But it's working. Mostly. But Poilievre does demonstrate a commitment to message discipline that Kevin Falcon could sure take a lesson from, because if the carbon price is a thing worth focusing on, I don't think it should be, but I guess it's where we're at. Poilievre has also been spending all week bringing doomed motions before Parliament to try and bring it down. First, a non-binding opposition motion saying we don't like the carbon tax, to which I think Kevin Vuong was the only non-conservative to vote for it, one of the independents, and then a confidence vote over the carbon tax, which also failed with pretty much everyone voting with the government. Even the Bloc, I think, voted with the government on both of those.
Not that you'd really expect that to succeed, particularly because there is a supply confidence agreement in place. It absolutely signaling bill, but yeah, it's what it is on that, and opposition parties do that every now and then on issues they think they have winning messages on. So yeah, the conservatives are intent on keeping up with that federally. Seems to be working for them, although I think ultimately that 1,000 subs may be a little more potent, but they clearly connect on just general cost of living as a broader connective tissue on that. And yeah, you know, it's not what I'd like to see them focus on, but with the carbon tax. But that's likely how it's going to play out, and likely the tax is probably not going to survive after the next election, which would be too bad. It's an interesting lesson, though, I think, in kind of as great as something can appear, you know, in an econ class, and you can get all the policy wants and the talking heads to talk about how elegant a policy it is. If it's not really politically sustainable, it's maybe not. Elegance maybe doesn't go as far as one would hope.
Technocracy doesn't survive democracy. No. The next election, though, won't be until October 2025 at the rate we're going, because it seems like the supply and confidence agreement is holding up and most of those items are getting checked off. But when that election happens, there'll be a few changes according to a new bill the federal government has introduced, which actually checks off one of those confidence agreement promises and commitments with the NDP. In this case, they are passing the Electoral Participation Act. This is Bill C-65, and it makes a number of changes largely to elections after 2025, but there are a couple that will come into effect this year. This is not electoral reform, as most people have talked about it for years in terms of changing the voting system, but it does change how we vote a little bit. So the things coming in right away will be to make the on-campus voting systems permanent and those programs, which is pretty positive for students who always face barriers to voting based on being away from their home riding or trying to figure out if they should vote in their university constituency. They're also going to continue to support making it easier to vote in long-term care facilities and other medical facilities. Some of the things people were looking forward to, or at least the NDP was trying to push forward to, Elections Canada pushed back on and kicked it down the road further. That includes spreading the election over 3 days and allowing you to vote at any polling station in your riding. That's something you can do municipally and I believe provincially. I don't actually remember now. I know you can do it municipally, though. Elections Canada says they need more time to figure out how to logistically do those two things, though.
So the any polling station, well, that one I can understand a bit, because it's the case, like, right now, you basically show up, and they have a printed list, and they cross your name off it. And they'd have to basically come up with a digital system that talks to each other and across the entire riding, which, you know, if this wasn't the government, it might be doable in 18 months, but...
the federal government, especially.
Yeah, particularly this government, 18 months, not a lot of time to really well do anything. The you just have more voting days and spread that out. That seems to be the sort of thing you can put in place in a lot less time.
And Elections Canada's big pushback on that is there, and I don't see how it would be any different in 2029 versus 2025, is they're not confident they can get polling stations for 3 days in a row, like if they're booking out community centers, schools, and those kind of facilities. So they need more time to, I don't know, think about it. Maybe complain about it.
4 years more time?
I don't know, Scott. I'm not Elections Canada. I don't know why they're slow rolling this.
This really feels like one of those things where they just don't want to do it and are coming up with an excuse why not to, more than they actually need the time.
Yeah, the bill does allow for more advanced voting days and makes it a little bit easier to vote by mail. For example, if you request a postal ballot, but then you end up just going to the polling station in person, you can just give that in, which makes sense. Like, that's just a common sense solution. You shouldn't have to vote by mail because you've got a postal ballot. And having more advanced voting days, I guess, is easy because those don't have to be every polling station. But yeah, I'm actually curious, though. I haven't looked it up, how many countries have multiple day elections. It's not something that I'm like, oh man, this would be amazing. I'd much rather just have election day be a holiday. And I'm not opposed to it. It sounds decent, but it doesn't necessarily solve too many issues for me.
Functionally, what's the difference between multi-day elections and a whole lot of advanced voting? There's still one day where it's the last day you vote and they count up all the stuff and announce who won.
You get more polling locations on a multi-day election versus advanced polling, I guess.
I guess.
But yeah. Well,
even these days, like, so many people do the advanced polls that I'm not sure there's actually that big a distinction to be had.
Yeah, it's like I'm...
The one thing I wish they would do is if they do have more advanced polls, that maybe they should make the writ a little longer. Like, by, you know, the second or third week, you've already had so much of the votes have started to get locked in and stuff. You've actually, like, practically truncated a lot of the election compared to what it used to be, and you maybe get a little bit more on the pre-writ just because with fixed election dates, you get a little more expectation or whatnot. But I don't know. The campaigner in me kind of wishes, and the election watch kind of wishes, you add a little more of that if you're going to basically compress the end so much.
Yeah. The one thing I will say about this bill is it also does give the government, as I read it, an extra week of life, assuming there's not, you know, a breakdown in the confidence agreement before then, because there's a subsection in here that says if Monday, October 20th, 2025 would be the day fixed for voting at a general election under this subsection, the general election must be instead held on Monday, October 27th, 2025. And like Wikipedia says, the next election is October 20th. And my plain reading of this is that they're changing this upcoming election by a week for shits and giggles.
And they... Man, do journalists really be desperate to hold on to the office for even 5 days more?
Like, we could scrap fixed election date laws and he could have an extra year. The Constitution only requires it every 5 years. But I don't fully understand that. I did note as well, like, there's a power in here given to the chief electoral officer to note other provincial and municipal elections that might make it inadvisable to have a fixed election date federally on the same day, and that he could recommend to cabinet to move it a bit, and he would have to do that early in the year. But that's another one of those kind of common sense recommendations.
Yeah, there's already a provision in there for that around advanced voting days.
Yeah, and they're also looking at
religious holidays and whatnot.
I was going to say.
So, yeah, it's not exactly unprecedented.
So, yeah, a bill that's a bunch of those kind of small, yeah, that makes sense, changes. There's some stiffer penalties for delivering false information about elections. So if you lie about voting stations, you could be charged with a crime. They're going to...
Yeah, so can't use prepaid gift cards
crypto
to make political donations.
Yeah, no Bitcoin donations to the Conservative Party once this bill is law. And then a little bit is also in there about cracking down on foreign influence of political parties and third parties. And a little bit more requirement that political parties have, I actually did read this bill clearly, political parties have privacy policies, and that they report those to the Canada Elections Officer, I believe. And so it doesn't really say, as far as I saw, how good those privacy policies have to be, but just that they have to have them. Bare minimum for our political parties.
Yeah, because they have not had to have them before now. Except perhaps in BC. I know that was being challenged. I can't actually recall where that ended up.
Me either.
There was a move to nullify it because it was basically intruding into an area of federal jurisdiction.
Indeed. So this...
We'll have to look that up.
So like I said, this bill, the NDP's Democratic Institutions critic, Daniel Blakey, was there with Dominic LeBlanc announcing this. And I believe Blakey's even retiring pretty soon to go work for the Canoe government. Triggering a by-election in Winnipeg. The bill, though, you know, has the NDP's support. It'll be worthy of study by the committees and the Senate, but it would be hard to not see this passing. There's not the most controversial thing probably in there is probably the restricting false claims about the elections because of the free expression. But
even that, it's if it's basically just strengthening the existing provisions, and you'll have to tell me if that's the case because I haven't actually read the bill itself. It's usually like pretty narrowly scoped to, you know, you can't tell someone the polling station is actually in a different spot than it is. It's not into the more fuzzy areas of, you know, how do you do interpret campaign statements and promises and all of that stuff that absolutely falls into free expression. It's very much a, you can't, you know, you basically can't lie to suppress the vote by telling people to do things that would make it so they can't vote. Which is reasonable, and I'm sure literally any poor would uphold that, even the much more free speech inclined U.S. courts, I'm pretty sure, would uphold that provision.
Oh, it will also be... that's all true, and you will also not be able to make false or misleading statements regarding the preliminary, validated, or official results of an election. So I can't say that Andrew Scheer won the 2019 election. That would be a crime.
So the Jeb meme becomes illegal in Canada, is what you're telling me.
You have to have the intention of affecting the results or disrupting the conduct of an election as part of this crime. So it's not even just that. It's a pretty high bar then.
So Jeb is safe.
All right. This checks off one of the supply and confidence agreements with the NDP, which reminded both of us, actually, you brought this to my attention, that it's the 2-year anniversary of Jagmeet deal.
I would have missed it if it hadn't been mentioned on, I think it was the Hubs podcast. Yeah. But yeah, it's the 2-year anniversary of the supply and confidence agreement.
That document that contains so many like vague commitments to plan to work toward things that it's hard to even grade it. But
You didn't generally consider most of the stuff's being checked off.
They've done the dental care. They've mostly worked towards a farmer care program, which is what they promised to do. They have invested in healthcare. You can't say they haven't. Have they done enough?
There was a big spending increase within the last year. I mean, it hasn't actually helped the fact that rural ERs can't stay open in this province. But money has gone out, and there is nothing this country loves more than to measure inputs rather than outputs when it comes to political announcements.
In terms of outputs, one concrete thing in here that hasn't happened for sure is the tabling of a Safe Long-Term Care Act. There was a consultation on that last summer. So in theory, we might see that in the next couple of weeks. But that's the largest outstanding item on here. The second section of making life more affordable for people was largely a bunch of like housing things for one additional year, like the Rapid Housing Initiative, then that for a year. The more substantive things, the Housing Accelerator Fund, the Home Buyers Bill of Rights were both done. We did the one-time top-up to the housing benefit. The Early Learning and Child Care Act has become law now. On the climate section, the only thing that I see on here that wasn't done was the Just Transition legislation. The government did move forward with a sustainable transition, I think, or a sustainable jobs plan, but it's unclear if they plan to bring it forward as a law. I don't even know what such a law would say. And I think the government doesn't want to use those words anymore.
Yeah, they've decided that's definitely not what they want to refer to it as.
The NDP got, in the next section, the anti-scab law for federally regulated workers. That came, at least that was introduced quite recently. I don't know if it's become law yet. On reconciliation, there was a lot of, do investments, accelerate the implementation of a plan, provide support.
Pretty generally describes a lot of the stuff. Moving forward on appears a lot in this document.
On the fairer tax system, I believe the government did do the changes promised on financial institutions, windfall taxes during the pandemic. It was a very narrow one. And we did get a legislation.
That's like basically raise no money, if I recall. Very, very minimal.
Right. And we did get a bill bringing forward a beneficial ownership registry. I don't know if that's launched yet, but that's moved forward. And this bill we just talked about on elections checks off this last one on making democracy work for people, that works with Elections Canada to do things like allow 3 days of voting, vote at any polling place, and improve mail-in ballots. Oh, but and they've also ensured that Quebec's number of seats has remained constant.
Because
both parties have Quebec MPs and want to keep them.
Yes, and wants to continue to pander to Quebec, even when it makes no sense as a way to apportion seats.
Scott, if you want more influence, start the British Columbia Separatist Party and get some momentum going. If we've learned nothing about federal politics in this country, is that regionalism can trump anything else.
And yet the Alberta also suffers from that same disproportionate seat allocation due to the government artificially boosting Quebec's numbers.
Yeah, and they launched a regional party that did really well, so much so that it took over the federal... progressive conservatives
has not
took over
fact,
government,
though.
But then realized that to maintain government, they had to keep some of Quebec happy. They had to keep Eastern Canada happy.
Their 2011 win, I believe they only got 10 seats in Quebec during that, which they could afford to shave a couple off there and still have won that election. The conservative path to majority does not necessarily run through Quebec, although I'm sure they'd be happy to pick up as many as they can.
Indeed. Well, it's been a productive-ish 2 years, I guess, for the Liberals and NDP. They have... I don't know.
They've checked off a lot of things, but it's hard to substantively say that this is going to affect a lot of people. People are really going to see a substantive change in their life from it. Now, if you're not taking one of the two medications that are part of the PharmaCare, if you're not in a federally regulated industry, you're not in the like very narrow slice that got means tested into a dental program and didn't have your own private dental coverage prior to that, there isn't actually a lot you're going to see come out of this are really going to affect your life all that much. They've gone through they've done well on the list checking exercise of it. I'm not sure as like a big set of policy changes that are going to be the sort of thing that can carry either party into the next election. There's a lot in here for that. And interesting, or something that I'm also a little curious about is, there's 18 months left till the clock runs out and the election's called, but I don't think there's 18 months left of things in here, which means there's going to be an interest in renegotiating this, and I am not sure if that actually comes together or how that's going to end up working out on that. So like, it may actually fall apart because it's quote-unquote successful in that respect.
I want to look back before I look forward. What's interesting to me is it feels, at least in a vibe sense, like the past 2 years has been more productive for the Liberals than the 3 years before that, the 2019 to 2022 period. I just haven't looked at what they actually accomplished in there or what they even did.
Yeah, they were like famously bad at moving bills through the legislature process at that point. No, nobody looked at the 2019 minority liberal government and thought, yeah, this is a government that legislates well or just uses the mechanisms of parliament.
Yeah, and I'd need to look back at like when the liberals started rolling out their child care support. I think it was before this agreement, but
I think it was it was before the last election they started doing that, because that was one of the wedges they were trying to wedge out the conservatives on, and I don't think it ended up being all that consequential, but it was definitely the seeds of that were pre this past election and hence pre the confidence supply agreement.
Yeah, so like the most charitable argument I can mount for the NDP on this agreement is not on the substance and the specifics, because they're crap and they're vague and they're things that the Liberals had said they were going to do anyway, for the most part, except the dental, I think, was the one that was like clearly from the NDP's platform. Everything else was in some form in the Liberals. Like the Liberals have talked about pharmacare forever. So I guess the question is,
yeah, that was in the John Trichetti Red Book.
If let's not go correctly. Back through all the things that were there but not done. I think the question then is for the for the NDP is, can they make the case that a lot of the things that have moved forward, around childcare, around the dental plan, around pharmacare, and more broadly on climate action, even, or sustaining the carbon tax, would those have happened in the absence of this agreement? Would the Liberals have gone more on austerity, or would they have, you know, not moved things at all? And that's a counterfactual we can never know. Like, we'll get into this motion in a second that we'll talk about briefly based on time, but it's also set up a dynamic where the Liberals and NDP are negotiating and talking a lot more. And the other unknown answer is, how much has the NDP been able to influence the Liberals' policies behind the scenes in different ways? In a way that, like, the Greens had an immense amount of influence and insight into the legislative process while they were in the supply and confidence agreement here, that they immediately lost out on as soon as they were pushed out of, they pushed out of government, essentially. Not that they were ever in government, but in pushed out of the agreement by John Horgan unceremoniously.
Well, they were no longer needed to hold a majority, so they lost all their leverage at that point. So, that's actually an interesting analogy on this, or precedent, is how much does the junior partner in this get out of it? And, yeah, they have some more influence in legislation and whatnot, and stuff that it will have, some of the stuff that passed definitely has some of the NDP's fingerprints on it. Only some, because, you know, if you'd asked the NDP what dental care or pharma care would have looked like in 2021, they would not have described the bills that passed at all. So it's very much a case of trying to get something that you can label as the same thing you were running on rather than what they were actually wanting to do. But also, the Greens did not really get any credit for what happened with the legislation and the changes that BC experienced in the time from the 2017 election up till 2020. And the NDP don't seem to be exactly prospering on the political front from this. Their poll numbers have remained mired more or less where they were at the end of the last election. Their fundraising is at best okay. They haven't really, they're not seem to be reaping any real political rewards from this. And at the same time, the government has gotten massively unpopular, and they've basically shackled themselves to the government, including doing stuff like in committees supporting liberals' attempts to avoid accountability on things like the Winnipeg lab breaches and all of that. And so it's more than just not voting, or it's more than just avoiding voting against the government on confidence motions to avoid going to an election or getting the specifics out of this. They've done some running of interference for the government in cases where I don't think Canadians were particularly thrilled at the idea of the Liberals having done that stuff or avoiding accountability for it. And I think that has, those decisions will not directly into this. I think there may have been some vibes that had affected the NDP's thinking on this, where they saw themselves as more supportive of the government than they need to be, or certainly acted that way, and as a result have kind of shackled themselves to an unpopular government that's not likely to survive the next election and are not going to be able to contrast themselves nearly as well with them come the next election, which also basically leaves the other main opposition party, the Conservatives, to basically scoop up any of the, well, we don't like the current government votes on that, because they are so tied together. So they may have gotten some wins, which, you know, they, like we said, checked off a bunch of stuff here. I'm just not sure that those wins are necessarily going to be worth the cost come election time.
The one counterfactual I'll put out there, which is kind of outside both of our experiences because neither of us lived, or at least were politically aware during the period, is the 1987 to 1990 Miller NDP coalition accord in Ontario, where the Liberals formed government with the support of the NDP in 1987, governed until 1990, when the NDP as the junior partner actually took a majority government under Bob Rae in that one. And the polling, looking at Wikipedia, actually had the Liberals in the lead in every poll conducted in that period, except the last one held like a week before the election.
In that one, if I recall correctly, the Liberals really like dramatically screwed up their campaign on that and basically threw a very winnable election on that. Can't even recall what the PCs were doing at the time, but basically it took both parties simultaneously running incredibly terrible campaigns in order to get that result. And yeah, is there an outside chance that could happen? I guess, but it's equally as likely that Jagmeet Singh runs a terrible campaign as anyone else does in this. And you know, all indications are the Conservatives are going to be pretty disciplined in their campaign and are going to have a lot going into it. I would be extremely surprised if we get a repeat of that at the federal level.
If 6 months is a long time for BC politics, 18 months is an eternity for federal. So, you know, maybe if Pierre Poilievre kicks a dog, he won't be prime minister at this rate. Anything can happen. And maybe Jagmeet Singh will kiss all the puppies and be the first.
Or aliens will land and we'll get him around the flag of
Davy Crockett on them, or whatever he said.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Thanks for listening.